His eyes traveled round the circle. I'm referring to the people. I admit that it was my idea originally that we attempt to foster a palace rebellion of some sort to install as king someone more favorable to the Foundation. It was a good idea. It still is. The only trifling flaw about it is that it is impossible. The great Salvor Hardin saw to that. Sir Max said sourly, "If you'd give us the details, Bort." "Details? There aren't any. It isn't as simple as that. It's the whole damn situation on Anacreon. It's this religion the Foundation has established. It works." "Well?" "You've got to see it work to appreciate it. All we see here is that we have a large school devoted to the training of priests, and that occasionally a special show is put on in some obscure corner of the city for the benefit of pilgrims, and that's all. The whole business hardly affects us as a general thing. But on Anacreon..." Lemtarki smoothed his prim little Van Dyke with one finger and cleared his throat. "What kind of religion is it? Hardin always said that it was just a fluffy flummery to get them to accept our science without question. You remember, Cermak, he told us that day..." "Hardin's explanations," reminded Cermak, "don't often mean much at face value. But what kind of religion is it, Bort?" Bort considered. "Ethically, it's fine. It scarcely varies from the various philosophies of the old empire. High moral standards and all that. There's nothing to complain about from that viewpoint. Religion is one of the great civilizing influences of history, and in that respect it's fulfilling..." "We know that," interrupted Cermak impatiently. "Get to the point."
"Here it is."
Bort was a trifle disconcerted, but didn't show it.
"The religion, which the Foundation has fostered and encouraged, mind you, is built on strictly authoritarian lines. The priesthood has sole control of the instruments of science we have given Anacreon, but they've learned to handle these tools only empirically. They believe in this religion entirely and in the spiritual value of the power they handle. For instance, 2 months ago, some fool tampered with a power plant in the Thessalakian temple, one of the large ones. He blew up 5 city blocks, of course. It was considered divine vengeance by everyone, including the priests."
"I remember. The papers had some garbled version of the story at the time. I don't see what you're driving at."
"Then listen," said Bort stiffly. "The priesthood forms a hierarchy, at the apex of which is the king, who is regarded as a sort of minor god. He's an absolute monarch by divine right, and the people believe it thoroughly, and the priests, too. You can't overthrow a king like that. Now, do you get the point?"
"Hold on," said Walter at this point. "What do you mean when you said Hardin's done all this? How does he come in?"
Bort glanced at his questioner bitterly. "The Foundation has fostered this delusion assiduously. We've put all our scientific backing behind the hoax. There isn't a festival at which the king does not preside, surrounded by a radioactive aura shining forth all over his body and raising itself like a coronet above his head. Anyone touching him is severely burned. He can move from place to place through the air at crucial moments, supposedly by inspiration of divine spirit. He fills the temple with a pearly internal light at a gesture. There is no end to these quite simple tricks that we perform for his benefit, but even the priests believe them, while working them personally."
"Bad," said Cermak, biting his lip. "I could cry, like the fountain in City Hall Park," said Bort earnestly, "when I think of the chance we muffed."
"Take the situation 30 years ago, when Hardin saved the Foundation from Anacreon. At that time, the Anacreonian people had no real conception of the fact that the Empire was running down. They had been more or less running their own affairs since the Zeonian Revolt, but even after communications broke down and Leopold's pirate of a grandfather made himself king, they never quite realized the Empire had gone kaput. If the Emperor had had the nerve to try, he could have taken over again with 2 cruisers, and with the help of the internal revolt that would have certainly sprung to life. And we could have done the same. But no, Hardin established monarch worship. Personally, I don't understand it. Why? Why? Why?"
"What?" demanded J. Morsi suddenly. "Does Verisov do? There was a day when he was an advanced actionist. What's he doing there? Is he blind, too?"
"I don't know," said Bort curtly. "He's high priest to them. As far as I know, he does nothing but act as advisor to the priesthood on technical details. Figurehead, blast him, figurehead."
There was silence all around, and all eyes turned to Cermak. The young party leader was biting a fingernail nervously, and then said loudly,
"No good. It's fishy."
He looked around him and added more energetically,
"Is Hardin then such a fool?"
"Seems to be," shrugged Bort.
"Never. There's something wrong. To cut our own throats so thoroughly and so hopelessly would require colossal stupidity. More than Hardin could possibly have, even if he were a fool, which I deny. On the one hand, to establish a religion that would wipe out all chance of internal troubles. On the other hand, to arm Anacreon with all weapons of warfare. I don't see it."
"The matter is a little obscure, I admit," said Bort. "But the facts are there. What else can we think?"
Walto said jerkily.
Outright treason. He's in their pay.
But Cermak shook his head impatiently. I don't see that either. The whole affair is as insane and meaningless. Tell me, Bort, have you heard anything about a battle cruiser that the Foundation is supposed to have put into shape for use in the Anacreon Navy?
Battle cruiser?
An old Imperial cruiser.
No, I haven't, but that doesn't mean much. The Navy yards are religious sanctuaries, completely inviolate on the part of the lay public. No one ever hears anything about the fleet.
Well, rumors have leaked out. Some of the party have brought the matter up in council. Hardin never denied it, you know. His spokesman denounced rumor mongers and let it go at that. It might have significance.
It's of a piece with the rest, said Bort. If true, it's absolutely crazy, but it wouldn't be worse than the rest.
I suppose, said Orsi, Hardin hasn't any secret weapon waiting. That might...
Yes, said Cermak viciously. A huge jack-in-the-box that will jump out at the psychological moment and scare old Venus into fits. The Foundation may as well blow itself out of existence and save itself the agony of suspense if it has to depend on any secret weapon.
Well, said Orsi, changing the subject hurriedly, the question comes down to this. How much time have we left, eh, Bort?
All right, it's the question. But don't look at me, I don't know. The Anacreonian press never mentions the Foundation at all. Right now it's full of the approaching celebrations and nothing else. Leopold is coming of age next week, you know.
We have months, then, Walto smiled for the first time that evening. That gives us time. That gives us time, my foot, ground out Bort impatiently. The king's a god, I tell you. Do you suppose he has to carry on a campaign of propaganda to get his people into fighting spirit? Do you suppose he has to accuse us of aggression and pull out all stops on cheap emotionalism? When the time comes to strike, Leopold gives the order and the people fight, just like that. That's the damnedness of the system. You don't question a god. He may give the order tomorrow, for all I know, and you can wrap tobacco around that and smoke it. Everyone tried to talk at once, and Cermak was slamming the table for silence when the front door opened and Levi Norrest stamped in. He bounded up the stairs, overcoat on, trailing snow.
Look at that, he cried, tossing a cold, snow-speckled newspaper onto the table. The Visicasters are full of it, too.
The newspaper was unfolded, and five heads bent over it. Cermak said in a hushed voice,
Great space! He's going to Anacreon! Going to Anacreon!
It is treason, squeaked Tarki in sudden excitement. I'll be damned if Walto isn't right. He's sold us out, and now he's going there to collect his wage.
Cermak had risen. We've no choice now. I'm going to ask the council tomorrow that Hardin be impeached, and if that fails...
5. The snow had ceased, but it caked the ground deeply now, and the sleek ground car advanced through the deserted streets with lumbering effort. The murky gray light of incipient dawn was cold not only in the poetical sense, but also in a very literal way, and even in the then-turbulent state of the Foundation's politics, no one, whether actionist or pro-Hardin, found his spirit sufficiently ardent to begin street activity that early. Johann Lee did not like that, and his grumblings grew audible.
It's going to look bad, Hardin. They're going to say you sneaked away.
Let them say it if they wish. I've got to get to Anacreon, and I want to do it without trouble. Now that's enough, Lee. Hardin leaned back into the cushioned seat and shivered slightly. It wasn't cold inside the well-heated car, but there was something frigid about a snow-covered world, even through glass, that annoyed him. He said reflectively, Someday, when we get around to it, we ought to weather gun.
I, replied Lee, would like to see a few other things done first. For instance, what about weather conditioning Cermak? A nice, dry cell fitted for 25 centigrade all year round would be just right.
And then I'd really need bodyguards, said Hardin, and not just those two. He indicated two of Lee's bully boys sitting up front with the driver, hard eyes on the empty streets, ready hands at their atom blasts. You evidently want to stir up civil war.
I do. There are other sticks in the fire, and it won't require much stirring, I can tell you.
He counted off on blunt fingers.
One. Cermak raised hell yesterday in the city council and called for an impeachment.
He had a perfect right to do so, responded Hardin coolly, besides which his motion was defeated 206 to 184.
Certainly. A majority of 22, and we had counted on 60 as a minimum. Don't deny it. You know you did.
It was close, admitted Hardin.
All right. And two, after the vote, the 59 members of the Actionist Party reared upon their hind legs and stamped out of the council chambers.
Hardin was silent, and Lee continued.
And three, before leaving, Cermak howled that you were a traitor, that you were going to Anacreon to collect your 30 pieces of silver, that the chamber majority, in refusing to vote impeachment, had participated in the treason, and that the name of their party was not Actionist for nothing. What does that sound like?
Trouble, I suppose.
And now you're chasing off at daybreak like a criminal. You ought to face them, Hardin, and if you have to, declare martial law by space.
Violence is the last refuge of the incompetent nuts.
All right, we'll see.
Now listen to me carefully, Lee.
30 years ago, the Time Vault opened, and on the 50th anniversary of the beginning of the Foundation, there appeared a Harry Seldon recording to give us our first idea of what was really going on.
I remember, Lee nodded reminiscently with a half-smile. It was the day we took over the government.
That's right. It was the time of our first major crisis. This is our second, and 3 weeks from date will be the 80th anniversary of the beginning of the Foundation. Does that strike you as in any way significant?
You mean he's coming again?
I'm not finished. Seldon never said anything about returning, you understand, but that's of a piece with his whole plan. He's always done his best to keep all foreknowledge from us. Nor is there any way of telling whether the radium lock is set for further openings short of dismantling the vault, and it's probably set to destroy itself if we were to try that. I've been there every anniversary since the first appearance, just on the chance. He's never shown up, but this is the first time since then that there's really been a crisis.
Then he'll come.
Maybe. I don't know. However, this is the point. At today's session of the Council, just after you announce that I have left for Anacreon, you will further announce officially that on March 14th next, there will be another Harry Seldon recording, containing a message of the utmost importance regarding the recent successfully concluded crisis. That's very importantly. Don't add anything more, no matter how many questions are asked.
Lee stared. Will they believe it?
That doesn't matter. It will confuse them, which is all I want. Between wondering whether it is true and what I mean by it if it isn't, they'll decide to postpone action till after March 14th. I'll be back considerably before then.
Lee looked uncertain. But that successfully concluded, that's bull.
Highly confusing bull. Here's the airport.
The waiting spaceship bulked somberly in the dimness.
Hardin stamped through the snow toward it, and at the open airlock turned about with outstretched hand.
Goodbye, Lee. I hate to leave you in the frying pan like this, but there's not another I can trust. Now please keep out of the fire.
Don't worry. The frying pan is hot enough. I'll follow orders.
He stepped back, and the airlock closed.
6. Selber Hardin did not travel to the planet Anacreon, from which planet the kingdom derived its name, immediately. It was only on the day before the coronation that he arrived, after having made flying visits to 8 of the larger stellar systems of the kingdom, stopping only long enough to confer with the local representatives of the Foundation. The trip left him with an oppressive realization of the vastness of the kingdom. It was a little splinter, an insignificant fly speck compared to the inconceivable reaches of the galactic empire of which it had once formed so distinguished a part. But to one whose habits of thought had been built around a single planet, and a sparsely settled one at that, Anacreon's size in area and population was staggering. Following closely the boundaries of the old prefect of Anacreon, it embraced 25 stellar systems, 6 of which included more than one habitable world. The population of 19 billion, though still far less than it had been in the Empire's heyday, was rising rapidly with the increasing scientific development fostered by the Foundation. And it was only now that Hardin found himself floored by the magnitude of that task. Even in 30 years, only the capital world had been powered. The outer provinces still possessed immense stretches where atomic power had not yet been reintroduced. Even the progress that had been made might have been impossible had it not been for the still workable relics left over by the ebbing tide of empire. When Hardin did arrive at the capital world, it was to find all normal business at an absolute standstill. In the outer provinces there had been and still were celebrations. But here on the planet Anacreon, not a person but took feverish part in the hectic religious pageantry that heralded the coming of age of their god-king, Leopold. Hardin had been able to snatch only half an hour from a haggard and harried Barisov before his ambassador was forced to rush off to supervise still another temple festival. But the half hour was a most profitable one, and Hardin prepared himself for the night's fireworks, well satisfied. In all, he acted as an observer, for he had no stomach for the religious tasks he would undoubtedly have had to undertake if his identity became known. So when the palace's ballroom filled itself with a glittering horde of the kingdom's very highest and most exalted nobility, he found himself hugging the wall, little noticed or totally ignored. He had been introduced to Leopold as one of a long line of introducees, and from a safe distance, for the king stood apart in lonely and impressive grandeur, surrounded by his deadly blaze of radioactive aura. And in less than an hour this same king would take his seat upon the massive throne of rhodium-iridium alloy, with jewel-set gold chasings, and then, throne and all, would rise majestically into the air, skim the ground slowly to hover before the great window from which the great crowds of common folk could see their king and shout themselves into near apoplexy. The throne would not have been so massive, of course, if it had not had an atomic motor built into it. It was past 11. Hardin fidgeted and stood on his toes to better his view. He resisted an impulse to stand on a chair. And then he saw Weenus threading through the crowd toward him, and he relaxed. Weenus' progress was slow. At almost every step, he had to pass a kindly sentence with some revered noble whose grandfather had helped Leopold's grandfather brigandize the kingdom, and had received a dukedom, therefore. And then he disentangled himself from the last uniformed peer and reached Hardin. His smile crooked itself into a smirk, and his black eyes peered from under grizzled brows with glints of satisfaction in them. "My dear Hardin," he said in a low voice, "you must expect to be bored when you refuse to announce your identity." "I'm not bored, Your Highness. This is all extremely interesting. We have no comparable spectacles on Terminus, you know." "No doubt. But would you care to step into my private chambers, where we can speak at greater length and with considerably more privacy?" "Certainly." With arms linked, the two ascended the staircase, and more than one dowager duchess raised her lorgnette in surprise and wonder at the identity of this insignificantly dressed and uninteresting-looking stranger, on whom such signal honor was being conferred by the Prince Regent. In Weenus' chambers, Hardin relaxed in perfect comfort, and accepted with a murmur of gratitude the glass of liquor that had been poured out by the regent's own hand. "Locrice wine, Hardin," said Weenus, "from the royal cellars. The real thing, 2 centuries in age. It was laid down 10 years before the Zionian rebellion." "A really royal drink," agreed Hardin politely. "The Leopold I, king of Anacreon." They drank, and Weenus added blandly at the pause, "And soon to be emperor of the periphery, and further, who knows? The galaxy may someday be reunited."
"Undoubtedly. By Anacreon?"
"Why not? With the help of the Foundation, our scientific superiority over the rest of the periphery would be indisputable."
Hardin set his empty glass down and said, "Well, yes, except that, of course, the Foundation is bound to help any nation that requests scientific aid of it. Due to the high idealism of our government and the great moral purpose of our founder, Harry Seldon, we are unable to play favorites. That can't be helped, Your Highness."
Weenus' smile broadened. "The galactic spirit, to use the popular cant, helps those who help themselves. I quite understand that, left to itself, the Foundation would never cooperate."
"I wouldn't say that. We repaired the Imperial cruiser for you, though my Board of Navigation wished it for themselves for research purposes."
The Regent repeated the last words ironically. "Research purposes, yes. Yet you would not have repaired it had I not threatened war."
Hardin made a deprecatory gesture.
"I don't know." "I do. And that threat always stood."
"And still stands now?"
"Now it is rather too late to speak of threats."
Weenus had cast a rapid glance at the clock on his desk.
"Look here, Hardin. You were on Anacreon once before. You were young then. We were both young. But even then we had entirely different ways of looking at things. You're what they call a man of peace, aren't you?"
"I suppose I am. At least I consider violence an uneconomical way of attaining an end. There are always better substitutes, though they may sometimes be a little less direct."
"Yes, I've heard of your famous remark, violence is the last refuge of the incompetent. And yet," the Regent scratched one ear gently in affected abstraction, "I wouldn't call myself exactly incompetent."
Hardin nodded politely and said nothing.
"And in spite of that," Weenus continued, "I've always believed in direct action. I have believed in carving a straight path to my objective and following that path. I have accomplished much that way, and fully expect to accomplish still more."
"I know," interrupted Hardin. "I believe you were carving a path such as you described for yourself and your children that leads directly to the throne, considering the late unfortunate death of the king's father, your elder brother, and the king's own precarious state of health. He is in a precarious state of health, is he not?"
Weenus frowned at the shot, and his voice grew harder. "You might find it advisable, Hardin, to avoid certain subjects. You may consider yourself privileged as mayor of Terminus to make injudicious remarks, but if you do, please disabuse yourself of the notion. I am not one to be frightened at words. It has been my philosophy of life that difficulties vanish when faced boldly, and I have never turned my back upon one yet."
"I don't doubt that. What particular difficulty are you refusing to turn your back upon at the present moment?"
"The difficulty, Hardin, of persuading the Foundation to cooperate. Your policy of peace, you see, has led you into making several very serious mistakes, simply because you underestimated the boldness of your adversary. Not everyone is as afraid of direct action as you are."
"For instance," suggested Hardin.
"For instance, you came to Anacreon alone and accompanied me to my chambers alone."
Hardin looked about him. "And what is wrong with that?"
Nothing, said the regent, except that outside this room are 5 police guards, well-armed and ready to shoot. I don't think you can leave, Harden. The mayor's eyebrows lifted. I have no immediate desire to leave. Do you then fear me so much? I don't fear you at all, but this may serve to impress you with my determination. Shall we call it a gesture? Call it what you please, said Harden indifferently. I shall not discommode myself over the incident, whatever you choose to call it. I'm sure that attitude will change with time, but you have made another error, Harden, a more serious one. It seems that the planet Terminus is almost wholly undefended. Naturally. What have we to fear? We threaten no one's interest and serve all alike. And while remaining helpless, Venus went on, you kindly helped us to arm ourselves, aiding us particularly in the development of a navy of our own, a great navy. In fact, a navy which, since your donation of the Imperial cruiser, is quite irresistible. Your Highness, you are wasting time. Harden made as if to rise from his seat. If you mean to declare war and are informing me of the fact, you will allow me to communicate with my government at once. Sit down, Harden. I am not declaring war, and you are not communicating with your government at all. When the war is fought, not declared, Harden, fought, the Foundation will be informed of it in due time by the atom blasts of the Anacharonian Navy under the lead of my own son upon the flagship Venus, once a cruiser of the Imperial Navy. Harden frowned. When will all this happen? If you're really interested, the ships of the fleet left Anacreon exactly 50 minutes ago at 11, and the first shot will be fired as soon as they sight Terminus, which should be at noon tomorrow. You may consider yourself a prisoner of war. That's exactly what I do consider myself, Your Highness, said Harden, still frowning. But I'm disappointed. Venus chuckled contemptuously. Is that all? Yes. I have thought that the moment of coronation, midnight, you know, would be the logical time to set the fleet in motion. Evidently, you wanted to start the war while you were still regent. It would have been more dramatic the other way. The regent stared. What in space are you talking about? Don't you understand? Said Harden softly. I had set my counterstroke for midnight. Venus started from his chair. You are not bluffing me. There is no counterstroke. If you are counting on the support of the other kingdoms, forget it. Their navies combined are no match for ours. I know that. I don't intend firing a shot. It is simply that the word went out a week ago that at midnight tonight the planet Anacreon goes under the interdict.
The interdict?
Yes. If you don't understand, I might explain that. Every priest in Anacreon is going on strike, unless I countermand the order. But I can't while I'm being held incommunicado, nor do I wish to, even if I weren't. He leaned forward and added with sudden animation, Do you realize, Your Highness, that an attack on the Foundation is nothing short of sacrilege of the highest order? Venus was groping visibly for self-control.
You mean none of that, Harden. Save it for the mob.
My dear Venus, whoever do you think I am saving it for? I imagine that for the last half hour every temple on Anacreon has been the center of a mob, listening to a priest exhorting them upon that very subject. There's not a man or woman on Anacreon that doesn't know that their government has launched a vicious, unprovoked attack upon the center of their religion. But it lacks only 4 minutes of midnight now. You'd better go down to the ballroom to watch events. I'll be safe here with 5 guards outside the door. He leaned back in his chair, helped himself to another glass of Locris wine, and gazed at the ceiling with perfect indifference. Venus blistered the air with a muffled oath and rushed out of the room. A hush had fallen over the elite in the ballroom as a broad path was cleared for the throne. Leopold sat on it now, hands solidly on its arms, head high, face frozen. The huge chandeliers had dimmed, and in the diffused, multicolored light from the tiny atomo bulbs that bespangled the vaulted ceiling, the royal aura shone out bravely, lifting high above his head to form a blazing coronet. Venus paused on the stairway. No one saw him. All eyes were on the throne. He clenched his fist and remained where he was. Harden would not bluff him into silly action. And then the throne stirred. Noiselessly, it lifted upward and drifted. Off the dais, slowly down the steps, and then, horizontally, 6 inches off the floor, it worked itself toward the huge, open window. At the sound of the deep-toned bell that signified midnight, it stopped before the window, and the king's aura died. For a frozen split second, the king did not move, face twisted in surprise, without an aura, merely human. And then the throne wobbled and fell the 6 inches to the floor with a crashing thump, just as every light in the palace went out. Through the shrieking din and confusion, Weenus's bull voice sounded, "Get the flares! Get the flares!" He buffeted right and left through the crowd and forced his way to the door. From without, palace guards had streamed into the darkness. Somehow the flares were brought back to the ballroom, flares that were to have been used in the gigantic torchlight procession through the streets of the city after the coronation. Back to the ballroom, guardsmen swarmed with torches, blue, green, and red, where the strange light lit up frightened, confused faces.
"There is no harm done," shouted Weenus. "Keep your places. Power will return in a moment."
He turned to the captain of the guard, who stood stiffly at attention.
"What is it, Captain?"
"Your Highness," was the instant response. "The palace is surrounded by the people of the city."
"What do they want?" snarled Weenus.
"A priest is at the head. He has been identified as High Priest Polly Verisov. He demands the immediate release of Mayor Selvar Hardin and the cessation of the war against the Foundation." The report was made in the expressionless tones of an officer, but his eyes shifted uneasily. Weenus cried,
"If any of the rabble attempt to pass the palace gates, blast them out of existence. For the moment, nothing more. Let them howl. There'll be an accounting tomorrow."
The torches had been distributed now, and the ballroom was again alight. Weenus rushed to the throne, still standing by the window, and dragged the stricken, wax-faced Leppel to his feet.
"Come with me."
He cast one look out of the window. The city was pitch black. From below, there were the hoarse, confused cries of the mob. Only toward the right, where the Argolid temple stood, was there illumination. He swore angrily and dragged the king away. Weenus burst into his chambers, the five guardsmen at his heels. Leppel followed, wide-eyed, scared, speechless.
"Hardin," said Weenus huskily, "you are playing with forces too great for you."
The mayor ignored the speaker. In the pearly light of the pocket atomo bulb at his side, he remained quietly seated, a slightly ironic smile on his face. "Good morning, Your Majesty," he said to Leppold. "I congratulate you on your coronation."
"Hardin," cried Weenus again, "order your priests back to their jobs."
Hardin looked up coolly. "Order them yourself, Weenus, and see who is playing with forces too great for whom. Right now, there's not a wheel turning in Anacreon. There's not a light burning except in the temples. There's not a drop of water running except in the temples. On the wintry half of the planet, there's not a calorie of heat except in the temples. The hospitals are taking in no more patients. The power plants have shut down. All ships are grounded. If you don't like it, Weenus, you can order the priests back to their jobs. I don't wish to."
"By space, Hardin, I will. If it's to be a showdown, so be it. We'll see if your priests can withstand the army. Tonight, every temple on the planet will be put under army supervision."
"Very good. But how are you going to give the orders? Every line of communication on the planet is shut down. You'll find that radio won't work, and the televisors won't work, and the ultrawave won't work. In fact, the only communicator of the planet that will work, outside of the temples, of course, is the televisor right here in this room, and I fitted it only for reception." Weenus struggled vainly for breath, and Hardin continued, "If you wish, you can order your army into the Argolid Temple just outside the palace, and then use the ultrawave sets there to contact other portions of the planet. But if you do that, I'm afraid the army contingent will be cut to pieces by the mob, and then what will protect your palace, Weenus? And your lives, Weenus?"
Weenus said thickly, "We can hold out, devil. We'll last the day. Let the mob howl and let the power die, but we'll hold out. And when the news comes back that the Foundation has been taken, your precious mob will find upon what vacuum their religion has been built, and they'll desert your priests and turn against them. I give you until noon tomorrow, Hardin, because you can stop the power on Anacreon, but you can't stop my fleet."
His voice croaked exultantly.
"They are on their way, Hardin, with a great cruiser you yourself ordered repaired at the head."
This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette.